This is News in Notes. I'm Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, Dems make a move to involve more voters up front. And doping in sports, is it just part of the game? Joining us from our bureau in New York City is Robert George, editorial writer with the New York Post. Also there, Marcelo Suarez Orozco. I see he is not there. Professor of Globalization and Education at New York University. He joins us today from member station WLIU in Southampton, New York. And Callie Crossley, social and cultural commentator on the television show Beat the Press, seen in the Boston area. She joins us from member station WGBH. All right, folks, let's talk a little bit about what we are hearing that the Dems have been, quite frankly, talking about for some time, and that is trying to get more color up front, if you will, more diversity up front in the primary votes. We're seeing a shakeup of a tradition, putting Nevada and South Carolina into what they call the first wave of presidential contest, along with the traditional votes from Iowa and New Hampshire. Marcelo, when we see this, what we also see, interestingly enough, is some infighting within the Democratic Party. Some don't want to see this move, just what Dems need, more infighting.
Indeed. In a way, it follows the demographic shift taking place in our country. The gravitational focus of our demography is moving very, very rapidly away from the Northeast and from those traditional states into the West, into the Southwest. If you look at the census data just released last week, Nevada is now one of the fastest growing states in the country. And the whole country really is moving, demographically speaking, and we'll see a new gravitational center that will be much, much more based in the West, in the Southwest, and that is an increasingly diverse population. It's a population with a growing share of Hispanic voters. So this will be, in a way, the story of the country moving forward.
Interestingly enough, Callie, one of the complaints from those who ran for the office of president is that often they believe that Iowa and New Hampshire had too much power. The momentum swing did not allow those that did not do well in that, in those primaries and the straw vote, could not often go on to states that they may have been able to garner more support and more votes in. We're seeing this in some instances, the ability to even out the playing field for those running for office.
Well, that's an interesting question. I think you're absolutely right. Those states have had way too much power. And in this day and time, as Marcelo has pointed out, it doesn't reflect a majority of the population. So it's crazy now in 2006, 2007, 2008 to be thinking about just Iowa and New Hampshire making the determination about who will be the leaders or the possible potential presidential candidates. What I think distresses me, though, is I think that I'm not certain that adding these two states is going to make a huge difference. For me, this is like a Band-Aid on an already broken system, because you're going to end up with having narrowed the whole field very early in the game. It does not allow for anybody to sort of bubble up from grassroots. It's just really hard if you're a candidate trying to garner some popular support in other ways. It's like these machines have complete control and the people are left out of it. Now, having said that, it is important to have a Nevada and a South Carolina because those are the two new additions. But I think what's going to happen is they're going to end up being in the same way, kind of powerful in their own way. And I'm not sure we'll still get down to the folks who are bubbling up from, who should be bubbling up from the bottom.
Robert George, so important to those on the Democratic National Committee who are pushing this that they are suggesting that there will be sanctions put in place for candidates who campaign in any state that refuses to follow the 2008 calendar of the primaries and caucuses there. That was approved on Friday. Now, we should note that all of this is not official, has not gone into place, will not go into place yet. But again, for the DNC to suggest that any candidate who campaigns in a state and not abide by the new calendar will be stripped at the party convention of delegates won in that state, that's pretty harsh.
Yeah, and I think that seems to be a little bit of overkill. I can understand why they want to try and shake up the map, if you will. but I'm not so sure, particularly when you call yourself the Democratic Party, making these kind of autocratic moves seems to go against the name of the party itself. One thing I will say, though, specifically for the in the context of the Democrats and the way this map plays out, Callie said it was going to, in a sense, prevent different candidates from bubbling up. I think this actually creates an interesting dynamic, given how Hillary Clinton is still perceived as the front runner. In fact, there was a poll over the weekend that said that, you know, she's still far ahead of everybody else. However, this new map actually makes it look good for, say, John Edwards, who's planning on running for president again, because he did very, very well in Iowa last time, and South Carolina, is definitely one of his base states. So I think that, frankly, could create a dynamic between himself and Hillary Clinton, and if they end up splitting some delegates along the way, that may open it up for two and three other candidates to come forward as well.
Here's what else it may do, Marcelo. Interestingly enough, we know that Iowa and New Hampshire received a lot of attention for potential candidates who had to spend a disproportionate and disordinate amount of time in these two areas. We just saw recently a poll that suggested that perhaps Hillary Clinton's polarizing effect is lessening over the course of the last couple of years. This does allow these candidates to broaden their scope and talk to a few more people and not be as concentrated in an area that, as you have so astutely suggested, is lessening and lessening in importance by virtue of the number of people who live in these areas.
We'll see more baskets, and the candidates will have to put their eggs strategically in a way, hopefully, that will be more balance of the diversity of the country and more balance of the distribution of power, demographic, economic, regional, in the United States.
Callie, the idea of being able to broaden the scope, some suggest, though, that that will not be helpful. The idea that you're splitting your time, losing some of the campaign time to travel and the like. Some people like the idea that even with this concentration, you were more apt to talk substantively about the issues because you spent more time in one place, therefore receiving that coverage. I don't know if it truly works that way, but that's the argument.
Well, yeah, around here, New Hampshire people would get insulted if they hadn't personally talked to all of the presidential candidates. I mean, that's how intense the campaigning in that state was. And for those of us who live in nearby areas in Boston, we're pummeled with those ads just forever and ever. So that's one thing. So you do get you get some attention, and you certainly hear a lot about what they say they're going to do. Now, I don't know how serious it is. I'm reflecting about what Robert said about allowing other people to bubble up, like the John Edwards. I guess what I was trying to think about is if there's somebody out there that we yet don't know about who has no name to come up, whether this kind of system will allow for that. I think Robert's right. The John Edwards and some of the other candidates will probably have a better shot at it going across these other states. And I personally think that in a couple of years, if this system holds, if they put this in place, that they will become as powerful, or perhaps even surpass the power of a New Hampshire because of the demographic shift.
Yet it's almost impossible, Robert George, in the world of politics we know today, to become, for instance, let's say a Jimmy Carter, where you start relatively unknown from the beginning, i.e. New Hampshire and Iowa, and find your way up. Chances are, this unknown doesn't happen in today's world. You have to be a known commodity pretty much going in already.
Well, yeah, and there are two reasons for that. First, obviously, is the money crunch. I mean, people basically started raising money for 2008 before the votes in 2004 were counted, or actually, frankly, they were probably raising the money even before then. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is that we have more news resources out there now. You know, it's not just the broadcast networks. Obviously, it's the cable stations, it's the internet, and so forth. And the debates that are fueled on the internet just make more politicians known. You know, it might have been, you know, in 1976, nobody would have known, say, if a Bill Richardson, for example, who had been an ambassador in the Clinton administration. Now he is a known quantity because of all the news outlets out there.
Marcelo, does this in fact, though, bring power at least to the issues of black and brown people by virtue of the fact that because these will be early on in the race, you're going to have to talk about issues of import to these communities?
Up front, I think that that will be the interesting issue to watch. In other words, how the early issues get framed and how having a different audience that you're dealing with might affect the kinds of concerns that bubble to the top. But I think the money issue is a fundamental issue, and I think the enduring questions that we're going to see addressed are really going to focus on Iraq. They're going to focus on the economy. They're going to focus on jobs. And these are national issues. These are issues that throughout our communities are we're clamoring for answers.
All right, let's turn our attention to the world of sport. We try to teach our kids, particularly those in Little League and the like coming up, that you want to play fair, and that's the way of the world in terms of a quality win, et cetera, et cetera. But when you get into the profession of sports, it doesn't necessarily always play itself out that way. We know that baseball has had an issue with steroids, with the lead of Barry Bonds and whether or not he has used performance-enhancing drugs. We know Floyd Landis has been under scrutiny since his win of the Tour de France. And now we're seeing five-time Olympic medalist Marion Jones, who is said to have failed a drug test in a championship in Indianapolis in June. They are awaiting her second results, and if in fact she proves positive now, could be banned for a number of years. Robert George, when we take a look at this issue of drugs in sports, some will say that the regular fan is just being naive. It's the way of the world. It is the advent of these drugs and the introduction of science to sports, and you better just get used to it.
Well, in a sense, yeah, we can almost say, you know, we are all East Germans now, because that was always the issue in the 70s and 80s that the Soviet bloc countries used all these performance enhancing drugs, and now that seems to, you know, just like weapons of mass destruction, everybody's wants to have that edge. I would say that it may be coming to a point where it's almost impossible to police this. And there are some libertarian people who say, you know, maybe it's just time to say, you know, fine, you know, allow athletes to use steroids, use them, you know, under a doctor's supervision, have medical standards set up in the entire system, and that may be the only way. That's maybe the only way we're going to go for it, because as soon as you manage to stamp out one over here, it's like whack-a-mole. You stamp out one and you toss one athlete out, then there are like two or three others who figure out another way to game the system.
Callie, what of the idea of this is just the evolution of sport? And we should note with Marion Jones, she has continue to deny, and this is not the first accusation of her, and we should note this is an actual test, but there have been accusations of her using performance-enhancing drugs over the years. She has continued to deny that. But one of the interesting notes is when you go from generation to generation as the world evolves, some people say that sport doesn't want to, i.e., you used to lift free weights, and then it went to Nautilus machines, and then there are all kinds of water weight build up programs now and things of that nature. What's the difference if, in fact, you are admitting to these performance-enhancing drugs and police them in some respects, as Robert suggested, with medical supervision and the like?
I think the difference is the whole point of the games was supposed to be that they were, you know, about who was the fittest and who worked the hardest. And I happen to be the fairy tale person on some issues. This is one of them. So I want to believe that she worked out and that everybody worked out hard. And they, you know, I want to believe Floyd Landis. I'm crushed when I did, because I can't do this stuff.
Callie, they worked really hard to get those drugs into their system.
Well, I mean, see how cynical Robert is. I'd like to think that, that people are really wanting to just be a good athlete, and it comes from the hard workout. With regard to having how to police it, I mean, I think one of the issues is that sports for a long time may have just dismissed it or turned its head, or the sports persons, and now they're taking it more seriously. They're having to, because the rest of us are saying take it seriously. So even if it is about whack-a-mo, as Robert says, and one pops up over here and one pops over there, I think it should be policed and policed strenuously. One more point about Marion Jones, if in fact, you know, this proves to be true, from a feminist womanist issue, I'm distressed that it appears that the way that drugs for her, that the way if this is true, were because of links to her relationships with various men in her life. And that's a little bit distressing as well. So,
yeah, we should note that her ex-husband was, in fact, convicted for using a performance-enhancing drugs. He, too, an Olympic athlete, or an athlete. I believe he was a shot putter.
And he was the father of her child and the trainer. So,
and you've got to keep in mind, too, what this may do actually do physically to the athletes. I mean, Florence Griffith Joyner had many – there were rumors about her, and there are questions about, even to this day, as to whether, you know, her
it hastened her death.
Young, young age may have been because of that.
Right.
Go ahead, Marcelo.
That's the thing to keep in mind. These are drugs. These are very powerful compounds that have serious side effects, serious complications, at a time when our sports figures are role models for our youth, for children. We need to keep that in mind, the idea that this could become widely used in an unsupervised context is very, very serious, very alarming, unfortunately.
Well, we should note, Callie, to lessen the fairy tale even more, that in fact is happening rampant in some areas of the country where high school sports are very, very popular. We have already seen historically the use of a steroid and other performance-enhancing drugs by young people who have yet to make the pro rank. So there's not even money involved at that point. So we will continue.
It's all about the win. It's the pushing about the win, as opposed to, you know, thinking about the health and what it means to compete fairly.
And you also have to take a look at how many, you know, look at all these GNC stores that have popped up. You know, I mean, there is just so much of a focus of, you know, using some kind of enhancement to get that edge.
All right. Well, I thank you all. And I guess, Callie, you were one of those who was happy that everybody had to play in the game.
Yeah,
all right.
That's right.
Marcelo, Robert, and Callie, thank you so much. Appreciate it.